So I'd like to welcome you to the fourth in the collaboratively organised series called Curating Europe's Futures, which is generously hosted by CCA here in Glasgow. The series was instigated by Katarzyna Kosoma from the Creative Futures Institute at the University of West of Scotland, by Lee French, who is an editor at Variant, a board member of Strickland Distribution, a PhD candidate at the Glasgow School of Art Graduate School, with support from the AHRC. Also organised by Jessica Carden and Tiffany Boyle, who are both PhD candidates at Train at the University of Arts London and at Birkbeck, respectively. They practice together in the research-led curatorial project called Mother Tongue. I'm Kirstine MacDonald. I am also a PhD candidate supported by the AHRC at Glasgow School of Art. I work independently as a curator under the office Parallel Lines, and I'm here primarily because I host a programme called Framework, which develops and supports curatorial discourse and practice across Scotland. So Curating Europe's Futures was established to explore contemporary curatorial and artistic practices that critically address themselves to the processes of socio-economic restructuring, identity politics, gender dynamics, and cultural policies within post-bloc Europe. As well as being the fourth event in this series, this evening's discussion is also the first in a two-part event, which is supported by a grant from the Scottish Graduate School for Arts and Humanities, which was developed in partnership with PhD candidates Caroline Goston at Robert Gordon University, Ariana Introna at the University of Stirling, and Susanna Thompson, lecturer at Edinburgh College of Art. This two-part project is called Blind Spots, Exploring Themes of Race and National Identity in Archives of Visual Art Through Curating. Our thanks go to all of these partners, to our filmer Stuart, and also to the Kingdom of the Netherlands, whose embassy has supported Maria being here today. So I guess in that illustration of the partners involved in tonight's simple talk, I wanted to highlight the kind of complexity and diversity of our own organisational structure as a collaborative entity, which in many respects is indicative to current conditions within the cultural sector. So where the resources of state and institutions that support independent cultural practice also put upon them various institutional agendas. And in doing so, what kind of subjectivities are called upon or brought into being? That's one of the key questions that we look at within the organising of these events itself in a sort of self-reflexive way. So what does having to be organised in this way currently conjure in terms of the ways that we come together, who we come together with, how we resolve the awkwardness of doing this, and how it implicates on our decisions and our power to act? The questions raised within our own organisational framework then also mirrors some of the questions that tonight's speakers, Rael Artel and Maria Lavajova, will address, especially in terms of recent projects that both of them have undertaken, which look at constructions of the we. In Maria's case, through the Former West project, which had 2 weeks ago in London, a public event which looked at the construction of the we. Rael Artel's recent exhibition and publication, Is This the Museum We Want?, will also be the focus of the second presentation. So our aim, as always with Curating Europe's Futures, is to look elsewhere so that we can reflect on how we do things, what we do, and the discourse here. So I'll introduce our first speaker. Maria is the founder and artistic director of BAC in Utrecht and has been since 2000. She's organised numerous projects at BAC and far beyond, including the series Future Vocabularies, New World Academy with Jonas Stahl, and the international research projects The Return of Religion and Other Myths in 2008, and On Knowledge, Production, Practices in Contemporary Art 2006, as well as numerous exhibitions with many artists that you'll know. In 2011, Maria organised the Roma Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, titled Call the Witness, and she also curated the three-part project Citizens and Subjects, which was the Dutch contribution to the 52nd Venice Biennale. In 2000, she co-curated Manifesto 3 in Ljubljana, And she serves, as you know, on various advisory boards and panels, as well as contributing essays and editorial work to various critical readers and catalogues. So the projects she'll talk about this evening are Future Vocabularies, which has been running from 2014, and Former West, which has been running from 2008, which she initiated and developed as an international collaborative research, education, publication and exhibition undertaking. So I'll hand over to Maria. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much, Kirsten, for this. I announced I would like to stand and walk, but this is going to determine the radius of my operation here. Thank you for the invitation. I cannot reproduce that impressive list of people to thank.
I don't know if it's impressive. Depressive.
what a collectivity! Thank you for being here and. I will need a little bit of your collaboration so that you tell me when to stop.
Okay.
Is that a way to go about this? Kirsten announced that I would talk a little bit about two projects I've been involved with, Former West and Future Vocabularies. And indeed, I will pull some knowledges from those two projects, but rather than kind of presenting rounded projects, I would like to rather share with you some of my uncertainties, actually, at this very moment, and perhaps urgencies and uncertainties at this very moment. And I'd like to start off from understanding of our time as a time of crisis. Sounds extraordinarily banal, but I would like to try to think about art in the time of crisis that manifests itself at the same time on numerous levels. Whether it's economic, as we all know, political, social, military, culture, aesthetic, environmental, and many other adjectives could be used here, which in fact kind of uncover a deep structural working of present capitalist democracy. What interests me, as I said, what is the space of art within the present time, so articulated. I would like to perhaps start from, if this works, from naming this time the time of interregnum. And I'm borrowing the term from Antonio Gramsci, political thinker, who wrote his notebook, his prison notebooks, almost 100 years ago, and he tried to define at the time what real crisis really is, by saying the crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Interregnum. Now, a number of thinkers actually argue that it's possible to apply this understanding of crisis onto our present time. You can think of George Agamben when he talked about the state of exception. But specifically, Zygmunt Bauman, sociologist Zygmunt Bauman, has talked a lot about how our time today is essentially time of interregnum. So it's not a typical capitalist crisis, but it's a moment where the old is dying and the new cannot be born. I think I brought a kind of longish quote here, which is from Zygmunt Bauman, where he says, Gramsci, taking a leaf from Lenin's memorable definition of the revolutionary situation, as a condition in which the rulers no longer can rule, while the ruled no longer wish to be ruled, Gramsci detached the idea of interregnum from its habitual association with the interlude of routine transmission of hereditary or electable power. He attached it to the extraordinary situations in which the extant legal frame of social order loses its grip and can hold no longer, whereas a new frame made to the measure of newly emerged conditions responsible for making the old frame useless is still at the designing stage, has not yet been fully assembled, or is not strong enough to be put in its place. Now, maybe Zygmunt Bauman is a bit too optimistic in his interpretation of Gramsci's definition of interregnum, because he is in a way promising that we're going to get out of this complex situation at some point. There will be a new frame established or put in place. However, to remind ourselves of Gramsci essentially says the new cannot be born. The crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Now, I think the period I want to talk about is what interests me greatly, and it's the period roughly from 1989, which we all know what happened. It was not just the end of communist rule over there behind the Iron Curtain, but it was the end of Cold War partitioning of the world in three worlds. Yet that promise of one world consisting of heterogeneous but equal parts, that promise has not been fulfilled. And I think instead, what we have seen over the last 20 odd years has been a sort of expansion and structural deepening of capitalist relations of production, which translated in a way into some sort of brutal sorting of winners and losers. That's how Saskia Sassen talks about the structural working of advanced capitalism, brutal sorting of winners and losers. And I would like to understand how this brutal sorting of winners and losers actually is played out in and through the space of art, and in particular practices of art. I would like to look briefly into how I learn what constitutes the space of art, which is artistic production, the circulation of art, and its audiences, the reception of art. Let me start briefly with this notion of artistic production. You will probably notice throughout the talk that I'm kind of interested in those critical artistic practices that adhere to that kind of ideal of imagining the world otherwise. Imagining and actualizing it. So rather in those practices, and not those that function as a kind of iconographic source, resource of advanced capitalism, or as a propaganda machine for distribution of technology of advanced capitalism, although many of you may protest, and rightly so, that the distinction is difficult to make, and perhaps even impossible to make. I would like to use this distinction as a kind of thinking tool for us, and you understand that I'm going to make a lot of kind of wide brush strokes, huge simplifications a number of times throughout the talk. I will be happy to discuss that further, but just trust me that I want to use it as a thinking tool to help us articulate certain things that bother me at this very moment. Now, if I want to examine that claim of changing the world in the field of art, sounds very naive, but it has been a motor, in a way, engine of artistic practice probably since at least romantic art movement, I think, to a great extent. If we want to examine that, we need to look at the practice of art as labor, in my opinion. Of course, we all understand how practices of art as labor changed dramatically in sync of post-40s artistic practices, but there are other things in this time, in this period of interregnum, that deserve some attention. And I think we all know, and this is going to be just a banal summary, as I promise it would be at some point within this presentation. Of course, under the regime of classical modernity, there was a clear distinction between artistic and non-artistic labor. We lost that distinction. I think it's there's a demand to any sort of labor to be creative, to be artistic, to be innovative, to be project driven, to not be repetitive, to be project oriented, etc., etc. Importantly, also, I think the all labor practices operate within the same factory, if you will, and that factory to which all labor practices moved is the internet. All labor is done digitally to a great extent, whether planning of it or labor as such. Plus the tools we're using in this big factory, it's a banal metaphor, but relatively helpful, we do not own, we do not control. And I think what we're facing is a typical industrial labor conflict of commonly shared workspace, yet the workspace not being owned or controlled by ourselves, and the same would count for all the Facebook, Google, and all other instruments that we are using. So this traditional dichotomy we grew accustomed to between cognitive and manual repetitive work continues to be there to a great extent. And I just would put up the a little citation from Boris Groys, who said in the context of formalism, artistic labor is becoming more and more representative of the functioning of society as a whole. This raises new questions concerning the role of the artist in society and the political dimensions of art. The artist loses his or her traditional role of the social outsider, preventing the artist from being able to see society as a whole, from an external position, as it were, hovering above the society. However, at the same time, it allows the artist to experience complicity and solidarity with all members of society. So I think what I would like to kind of, I would like us to remember while I develop some other thoughts in parallel, is this idea that's kind of suggested here, the idea of art for all, or rather perhaps art by and from all, that already begins gesturing towards this idea, notion of we differently than how we learned it. I think what's important to remember is that artist perhaps loses her position of standing above the society and kind of commenting upon society and providing guidance in a sort of, you know, imaginaries, but in return gains different understanding and kind of solidarities, and the notion of collectivity is being gained from this process. Now, if we keep this target for a while, just returning back to Gramsci's quotes, because it would be quite interesting, in my opinion, to examine what is that all that is dying? What really is it? And the question that I would like to pose for this conversation is, what if that which we are parting from, that all that is dying, is the legacy of Western modernity? And just to examine what would that possibly be, we could look at the paraphernalia of, or the building blocks of modernity. And of course we would immediately have to think about the notions such as progress and future, critique, and culture, nature division. I think they are all being retooled under the pressure of contemporary realities into something that one could call survival, not progress. It's not no longer about the betterment towards a better future. It's more about the tactics of survival in a way. And the same account for the nature-culture divide that defined modernity, right? I mean, number of thinkers launch a number of different terms, but it's Anthropocene that is all in a, that is also in some way articulating the strategy of survival rather than anything else, or of course nature cultures, as Donna Haraway has it, or Bruno Latour. An example of critique, just take that, because for our field it's so important. Huh? We talk about critical artistic practices, we talk about art criticism, and there have been a number of efforts made to think of criticism, criticality, and other such terms. But interestingly enough, critique relates etymologically to crisis, huh? From krino in Greek, in a way, which essentially means gathering negativity from the present moment, in order to, in a way, set up an opinion or a tribunal, even as many art critics, I think, do. But it also, critique requires to maintain the situation you critique in action, in a way. Right? To keep critique active, you need to keep the conditions you critique active as well. And I think in order to figure out ways how to move beyond this interregnum, it would be rather important to retool that notion of critique, or perhaps leave that critique behind altogether. And I think for me the most important thing that I would like to stress throughout, perhaps, is to make the motion that move from critique to proposition. I think that's what constitutes survival, the move from critique to proposition, and perhaps even ethical survival. It's a survival, it's a move not against the circumstances at hand. So it's not this kind of oppositional dialectics, but it's a move in spite of the circumstances at hand. And I think that move from against to in spite, of from critique to proposition, is something really important and significant for this moment. Let me move to three examples. I'll rush through them because I see I have a timer here and it goes fast. This is the first example I would like to show you. It's the work by Arnold Mick, Dutch artist, with whom I worked a lot. It's called Cardboard Walls, from 2013 video installation. The work brings us to the immediate aftermath of Fukushima nuclear disaster in 2011. The project is done in 2013. This is a living habitat of people who've been evacuated from the Fukushima region. So literally cardboard walls, small apartments, makeshift apartments of the refugees or evacuees from the area. Arnold Mick was commissioned to do work around Fukushima, so he came with his budget to the evacuees and actually asking, what is it that you need, right? It's kind of, this is what political art has been doing, kind of going to the side of some sort of disaster, tragedy, and kind of, you know, putting the camera on and filming, and he wanted to circumvent that kind of, you know, move of so-called critically engaged or political art. Interestingly, what they requested was an apology. What the evacuees from the Fukushima disaster area wanted was an apology. The artist went to TEPCO management. Of course, they were not capable of offering an apology to the evacuees, so he agreed with the evacuees that he will set up a performance where the only actors on the set would be those. I need to do something.
Just there.
So it was a consensus of the people, of the evacuees and the artists, that he would bring actors to reenact the apology that they desire, that they yearn from the situation. Apology in Japanese culture means something really significant, and you see, it was this lengthy ritual of going from apartment to apartment to go really to offer an apology. it created a very complex kind of situation where people living in these makeshift apartments started to destroy everything, to destroy the habitat in which they lived. There was the slide before we managed to put this one up. And it was quite shocking experience. Arnold Mick always works with huge crowds of people, but never scripts the scene. It's more creating a situation and having people do whatever they find important themselves at that particular situation. So actually, as a reaction to the apology, the whole habitat, this makeshift cardboard walls, were completely destroyed until kind of collective realization that this destruction, the repetition of the destruction, doesn't bring us anywhere, and started to build and rebuild the habitat in a way, and start to build monuments in a way to that kind of newly found solidarity, collectivity, to a great extent. I'm rushing through this, so I'm leaving lots of details behind. Just this is an installation in the gallery, so that you see that, in a way, the visitors had to go through the installation and become part of it, which I think was a very important kind of signal of saying we are in this together, right? It's a sort of unnatural disaster, Fukushima. It's not a problem of Japan, for example. It's the problem that doesn't stop at the border, on one hand, and it's a problem that cannot be resolved by a single state or conglomerate of state, and will not be resolved by the market either. I mentioned the notion of uncertainty. I think in the late 80s, we, together with Ulrich Beck to a great extent, talk about our society as a risk society. I think that has changed in the time of interregnum, and I think we could safely talk about present society as a society of uncertainty. And although it sounds like a very negative kind of label for the time, uncertainty is a quite interesting thing. And it really importantly was played out here in this film, because this notion of acute uncertainty surrounding such a reality like here or ours, even here in this room, one could think about it as something extraordinarily constructive. Because if you're uncertain, all outcomes are still possible. Mm-hmm. And so I want to look at that label as something relatively hopeful, as something that can offer a way out, can carry some sort of possibility. As we saw here to a great extent. I think what's happening here is a sort of realization that what we thought we created and had under control within that risk society, for example, market doctrines. We created markets, and we thought we have it under control, or things we thought we controlled, such as nature, actually suddenly started to take control over our lives. And that's that important moment that co-defines the situation of interregnum to a great extent. I think there are three very important elements that are important to deal with in the time of interregnum that this work actually articulates. One is what Zygmunt Bauman actually calls institutional disparity. And what he talks about is the very fact that power and politics are just incapable of connecting to one another. If politics is capacity to think through solutions to our problems, and power means capacity to implement these solutions, what we have at this very moment is powerless politics and politic-less power, in a way. That's the situation of the times of interregnum, which needs to be dealt with. The other is probably the out of three really crucial elements that one needs to pay attention to is the notion of immigration, and of course the future of the planet and durability of the planet. And I think this work, in a fascinating way, brings all these three huge concerns of the time of interregnum together. Now, the word cardboard walls by Arnold Mick prefigures something really important in its content. But I want to see how these kind of concerns, these new emergent collectivities, uncertainties in the time of interregnum, actually get incorporated or dealt with in emerging new institutions that I see around me, and what kind of impact these issues have on the notion of spectatorship. My second example is the New World Academy, which is a learning platform that Dutch artist Jonas Staal established together with BAC, the institution I'm a director of. It's a learning platform that brings together artists, students, and progressive political movements, stateless progressive political movements, brings them together to deliberate around the notions of art and politics differently than how we understood these two terms up until now. And not only learn from one another, concrete tactics, for example, theories, but also organize exhibitions or organize other sort of events, etc., etc. These are four covers of four semesters that we organized. Just as an example, there was a project organized with the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines. There was a project organized with We Are Here group. I'll talk about that in details. International Pirate Parties on Leaderless Politics, and with the National Liberation Movement of Azawad, MNLA, which is military and political organization of the north of Mali, desiring independence for the state of Azawad. Again, a lot of details that I'm leaving behind. I just want to focus really briefly on this one, Lost in Between Together, which was organized with a group of undeportable refugees. We are here. Just very briefly, and again, this account cannot do justice to the situation, but undeportable refugees, or as Dutch juridical language has it, undeportable aliens, are just in brief people who are former asylum seekers who applied for asylum and they didn't receive it. They didn't receive the asylum. So within normally 72 hours, they are supposed to be deported, yet they are undeportable for a variety of reasons. In majority of reasons, the country from which they escaped no longer exists or is at war, so there are no institutions to which so-called hosting country, what a euphemism, the Netherlands, could connect in order to deport these people back to their countries. So the Dutch state says, well, you are undeportable for us, we request that you deport yourself. Of course, they cannot deport themselves, and all they can do is actually seek for places where they could survive with zero support of the state. There is an estimate there's 50,000 such undeportable aliens in the Netherlands in complete illegality, in a way, which the Dutch government at this moment tries to criminalize. So if you're illegal, you should be put to jail. There's no lawyer that could possibly get you out of that crime, in my opinion, not that I would know. However, a lot of police raids, evictions, etc., until the mayor of the city of Amsterdam offered the refugees, each of them, €250 if they disappear. There was somebody asked very humbly, what would that disappearance mean? Ideally, you would go to another city, so you're no longer my problem. And that's actually created this political organization called We Are Here. What do you mean, we are here? Right? It's historically also quite important kind of slogan throughout a number of political movements. These are people who have no rights to have rights, right? Hannah Arendt's claim. These are people who have no rights to have rights. So even political organization of this sort, or this move from invisibility to fragile visibility, is extremely dangerous here. Interestingly, with the support of mainly Dutch Protestant Church and contemporary artists, this group is surviving by creating by creating a cooperative between refugees and artists, and operating it as a kind of alternative economic unit. In an interesting way, what we did with the New World Academy, that we would set up a school where the refugees are teachers. They teach the skills of survival to some extent to students, to artists, to politicians, and we created a platform for negotiation of their presence in the Netherlands. Interestingly enough, artists would, for example, collect their own cameras and give it to the refugees, because them being undocumented, as a kind of, it started as a joke, whatever you do, document whatever you do, to such an extent that actually it creates visibility, so that the Dutch state in a couple of cases had to afford a give people the residency permit, which is quite interesting. However, within the Western law at this very moment, these people cannot work. That's not allowed. So even artistic labor is not allowed. But one thing the state cannot take away from them is creative expression. There's a freedom of creative expression, and that's a kind of loophole within which this artistic artistic refugees cooperative exists. Dividing the group into a number of kind of workable units, it's we are here to lobby, we are here to cooperate, we are here to cook, we are here to teach Arabic, we are here to do this and that. So it kind of becomes very interesting alternative economic circuit, which is not just imagining the world otherwise, but in some way actualizes this. Just perhaps a note about these are just sessions from the workshop. As an art institution back where this is happening, we can easily invite Secretary of State to come over. He doesn't show up, of course. He had to resign because of a huge fraud 2 weeks ago. But what we can do, for example, is to interlocute, and I think this is a crucial role of art institutions within the period of interregnum. It's to interlocute. So this is, for example, in an event in a political debate center in Amsterdam, where they try to the cooperative try to organize an event previously in order to reach to the places of political power. They wouldn't alone, but if us as BAC, as institution, go and ask for collaboration with the same very same institution, it's possible. For me, this is this function of interlocution, of connecting care to power, in a way. This is from that event, and this is just to introduce how what the situation really is in the Netherlands, because under the pressure of the European Union, the Dutch government had to offer for winter months a place for these people to live. Of course, given even if there are millions of empty square meters of buildings in the country, the only building they come with is an empty yet fully functional prison. An undeportable alien per cell. So what's happening here? What's happening within this kind of practice? I think what's happening here, it's to great extent kind of understanding those solidarities, commonalities amongst artists and, in this particular case, undeportable refugees, and trying to enact, actualize, or some sort of other possibility of being together in the world. I think some sort of lending of not expertise but competence was taking place here to a great extent. I think artists were lending their artistic competence to members of the collective in order to figure out livelihood, in a way. While refugees were lending kind of art out of survival competencies to the artists and students to such an extent that when they were teaching lessons on democracy, each of them would, for example, bring a tool for survival in democracy, which ranged from a sleeping bag to gas mask, to a huge surprise of art students not quite understanding how come that Western sort of democracy would require these tools for survival. I think what's happening here is somehow the realization of that imperative that I mentioned in the beginning, the art for all or art by all to a great extent, or art from all. Yet, by other means that neoliberal discourse would want us. Right? It's not about cooptation of solidarity, in a way, into the neoliberal desires. It's not about that sort of participatory culture, where you feel privileged to have to figure out your own life. But I think it starts gesturing towards something that I would like to talk about in my remaining few minutes, and that's the commons, the culture of the commons that I see happening here and a number of other examples. Now, what we know as art activist practices from the 60s onwards, or something that we in the 1990s named political or politically engaged art, I think those were those art practices that were anti-capitalist in their own way. So that kind of anti, to be against something. I think here we see precisely the shift I was playing for in the beginning, the shift from being against something, shift from critique to proposition. I think these practices don't exist as anti-capitalist, but in some way post-capitalist, because they do exist in spite of the circumstances at hand. I think they do not adhere to either public or private culture as we know it within the Western context, right? Like state-led public practices and market-led private practices. I think in the current constellation in the West, this distinction is false. We cannot distinguish between private and public because everything is determined by the so-called private sphere, in a way. Under the pressure of withering of social democratic consensus for, I know it's a complex question when it comes to Great Britain, but also rise of network cultures, inevitability of other forms of self-organizations in comparison to what we knew before. So I have specifically in mind this idea of commoning. The question is, what do we do with those traditional conceptual itineraries of modernity that define our operation in the field of art? And I would specifically talk about authorship, ownership, spectatorship, and expertise culture. How does that connect to what I'm trying to show you here, really? I think we see a new sort of political subjectivity appearing from within these sort of practices. There's very little I could find when it comes to theories, but I think Stephen Wright comes really close with a very interesting proposition of usership, trying to suggest what if we thought of art not as a minoritarian activity, but majoritarian activity, art from all, art for all, art by all to some extent, and try to understand art, for example, similarly as we, for example, see the language. Huh? He turns to Wittgenstein and the famous statement, don't ask don't ask for value, or don't ask about value, ask about use. What if we, so in terms of language, it's quite clear. I mean, we all use language, we all contribute to it, we all author it. I think that's one of those items that have not yet been capitalized upon when it comes to language. I don't know who owned the language. I hope we all commonly own it in a way. But we don't need to be experts. We don't need to be linguists in order to contribute, in order to use it, etc., etc. So this is kind of proposition Stephen Wright is making. What if art was precisely the same sort of thing we all have at our disposal that we can use in different ratios, wherever needed. Now, this is one of the demonstrations of We Are Here, and I thought I would put up this banner. It's kind of familiar image, in my opinion. There's so many demonstrations. There's so much disenchantment going on in the world. And when I looked at this, I was thinking of Brian O'Doherty, actually. Probably you all read Inside the White Cube, famous 1976 book. And there's one wonderful paragraph that I never took seriously or never even noticed that was there until I started to look at these things, because Brian O'Doherty talks about a male subject contemplating inside a white gallery. And he asks, who is this male contemplating inside the gallery? And he uses a couple of terms for that male contemplating inside of gallery. Always alone, always turned with his back to the rest of the crowd. I don't see any we happening. There's no we formation of a we inside the white cube. And he calls this male contemplating inside the white cube spectator, viewer, observer, perceiver. And if I look at this image, I don't see spectator, I don't see viewer, I don't see observer, I don't see perceiver. I don't see subjects of relational aesthetics, something that kind of hijacked our imagination about art for some time. I don't see visitors to art exhibitions amongst these people on the street. And I don't see consumers of art. This is something what the Dutch government at this moment requires from art institutions, to cater to consumers. Consumers of art. This is no general audience the way we conceptualized it under the regime of the modern. And I think this is very important to realize and ask ourselves a question: if none of these qualify spectator, observer, viewer, consumer, visitor, what does? I think specifically in face of global mobilizations that we see today, Indignados, Occupy, Anonymous, Tahrir, Gezi, Kurdish women movement, the undeportable refugees collective We Are Here, I mentioned, but also precarious artists, the Cognitariat, freelance writers, sounds very beautiful, no? Self-employed curator, freelance writer. But essentially unemployed culture workers, unemployed curators, self-employed art critics, indebted students, as well as many other discontents and discontented that are yet to be named. A very serious question for us in the field of art is, where do art institutions and artists seek for their audience? And where do these people search for their artistic and political institutions? And I think if we set the picture this in this kind of simplified ways, I think we're facing a serious trouble when it comes to how is the composition of artistic culture and political infrastructure in the world at this very moment. Before I use my last 3 minutes for my last example, I just want to say that, of course, there are a number of theories, whether it's precariat, that brings together people very well educated, indebted, anxious, angry, very often in poverty, together with you know, groups, social groups that they never imagined to be part of, whether it's Roma, whether it's homeless, jobless, whether it's undeportable refugees and other. We in the north of global north have huge difficulty to acknowledge our own precarity. We still behave as middle class. We're still well educated, we dress as middle class, we behave as middle class, but if we follow Saskia Sassen, who says, look at the data, then we realize what capitalist dispossession has done to that kind of middle class that would go to gallery on Sunday afternoon and to theater on Friday. A remark here probably that's the very much picture of global north to a great extent. If you talk about global south, the movement there is very different. Social actors pull themselves out of poverty and enter so-called middle class, although I want to say that how we articulated middle class in the so-called West is very different from anthropological definition of middle class at this moment in Brazil, India, and elsewhere. Let's call this precariat for the lack of better word, or perhaps something that I would like to call these crowds, these we, these people, future publics. There's no longer distinction between artists and their audiences. There is no distinction between artistic production and circulation actually going on here. But if we think about these we as future publics, we need to understand they are not only produced by the era of interregnum, but they also produce it. So there is this very complex working between emergency and emergence, which is rather important to acknowledge. Last 3 minutes I have. Skipping. Teatro Valle Occupato, I'm going just to mention really quickly, as one of those institutions that try to act as the institution of the commons. The notion of the commons is an economic construct, but also a way of being together in collectivity. Typical story, Teatro Valle Occupato in Rome, under the austerity situation, the government sold the building in the city center, first theater catering to public, not bourgeoisie, but public, which is quite important to say here. However, the government sold the building into private hands to be turned into a shopping center, typical neoliberal operation, of course we know. All workers of the theater started to occupy. This was 4 years ago. The occupation took 3-4 years almost, and indeed a kind of motley of citizens, workers of the theater, actors and other, under the motto, like air and water, culture is a commons. Like air and water, culture is a commons. Claiming this is a public theater, it means it's ours. Again, Western legislation does not recognize something like commons. So it's essentially a legal operation. Eh? We only recognize so-called private and so-called public. We understand that it's the same thing. So this was the whole thing, the whole 3 years about police raids, evictions, etc., while I think these people working and living there together for 3.5 years enacted another sort of political living, claiming culture is ours, we are going to take care of it. Against the word of police and government saying, no, it's not yours, it's ours. Only under, they got out on 10th of August 2014, when, and this is the fascinatingly successful strategy, when the building inspector announced that the roof is about to collapse, and under this so-called condition, the whole group evacuated voluntarily the building, which immediately got into a reconstruction process for them to be turned into the center. 1 minute. Instead of a conclusion, this is a this is a campaign the Teatro Valle Occupato used to talk about the commons. Art you lost. Only an Italian can come up with this wonderful, wonderful language. Of course, this was to mobilize people to understand they need to fight for their art, for their culture. But on the other hand, they claim that this is a way to think through an antithesis to competition, financial speculation, colonial environmental plunder, exclusion and social justice, because that's in what so-called contemporary art is implicated. And to get rid of it, they said we are prepared to lose art. And I think this is a really heavy statement, talking about, like, we don't want to be corporate design workshop for neoliberal capitalism. We don't want to be pay-per-view, leisure kind of non-occupation. We want to be something else. We want to reclaim culture for us in collectivity with others. And I think they would be claiming similarly to what Tania Bruguera names contemporary artistic practices, art as a method and tactics to access political life. That's that practice of interlocution, which is very interesting, I think, to look at and think through. Now, for those of you, maybe all of you, all of us ask, but is this art? Right? The only way to answer this question would be to borrow the term of Bernadette Buckley. Well, it's not art either. And I leave it here for the discussion. Thank you.
Just so that we don't go too long over, I just want you to invite any...
3 minutes.
I know. No, I mean as a whole.
Oh.
As all of us. The implication of...
Behave, which is quite unique.
No, it was very focused,
yeah.
and didn't overrun in a conceptual sense by any means. I know there's a lot of people in the audience who could instigate a very good discussion around this big question, but I feel like we might want to leave that slightly to the end, so I'd just invite any immediate responses that people want to make before we break.
Break.
I'll do 3, 2, 1. In that case, save them, and we can ask all the big, difficult questions at the end after commenting, because I think it'd be interesting to get conversation out of that as well, make time for that. So we'll have a 10-minute break, and then start back at 3:25.
Thank you.
I wasn't laughing, I was laughing. She's doing some kind of dance.